Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith. We turn once again to our discussion with Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald, the husband and wife writing team who were the only journalists to gain access to Afghanistan in 1981, then co-wrote the book Invisible History, Afghanistan's Untold Story. Their website is www.invisiblehistory.com.
From 1973 on, that's when Pakistan and the CIA get actively involved.
Last time we heard about the rise to power of His Royal Highness Sardar Mohammed Daoud.
They say, look at this guy in Afghanistan. He's really the Red Prince. He's just pulled off a coup with a communist who's friendly with Moscow. We've got to do something about this.
Author Paul Fitzgerald.
1973 was when the CIA and the Pakistani ISI got together and said, okay, what can we do about this?
Elizabeth Gould chimes in about a warlord named Gulbuddin Hekmatyar.
There is an individual named Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, who is today one of the key players that they talk about bringing back into the Afghan government. He received the bulk of Charlie Wilson's money that came out of the Saudis and Washington through Pakistan. And Gulbuddin Hekmatyar in the early 1970s was charged with throwing acid in the face of women at Kabul University. And due to other circumstances, he eventually fled Afghanistan and was taken in by Pakistani intelligence in the 1973 insurgency that the United States became involved in through Pakistan involved Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and Ahmed Shah Massoud. These are the two key Mujahideen players. And Massoud, of course, he was the one killed right before 9/11, and he was the head of the Northern Alliance that they had hoped was going to help bring stability to the country. But in these early days, these guys were actually extremists in relation to the way in which Afghanistan had been functioning, and they were absolute misogynists. They got embraced by Pakistani intelligence, and they started the campaign from Pakistan to destabilize Daoud's regime.
This is from 1973 until 1978. So Barbara Karmal's Parsham faction gets de-emphasized, okay, and discredited. And the other faction, the Khalq faction, which are mainly Gilzai Pashtuns, led by Nur Muhammad Taraki and Hafizullah Amin, the man being educated in the United States, suddenly they impose a coup in the spring of 1978. And that is the beginning of the end for the Afghan nation. Hafizullah Amin consolidates his power over the next year and a half. The U.S. ambassador, interestingly enough, Adolf Dubs, the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan under this regime, he was said to have met with Amin on many, many occasions. He was clearly trying to work Hafizullah Amin back towards the United States and away from any relationship with the Soviet Union. At the time, there were these kind of gray areas between the East and the West. There was Yugoslavia, as an example, Tito in Yugoslavia. There were a number of different dictators, military dictators in various parts of the world that were nominally communist, but really were kind of friendly with the West, with the United States. And so that's what this U.S. ambassador was trying to do, was trying to wean him away from the Soviet Union towards the United States, but then help him establish a kind of more moderate, non-aligned government. In other words, returning Afghanistan to a kind of buffer state. Well, this got very, very complicated because it came up against a lot of different agendas that were very active during that time period. And these agendas that Pakistani, Iranian, Saudi Arabian, Chinese group was very interested in doing something with the Soviet Union. There's a lot of issues here that were never really discussed at the time.
And you also have to include Zbigniew Brzezinski, who really played what was referred to as the China card, which changed the dynamics. Once that coup took place in 1978, Brzezinski was beginning to develop relationships with the Chinese to basically assist in the financing and the distribution of monies to the Mujahideen that were forming, and these were the insurgents that were being, you know, housed in Pakistan at the time.
This is almost like a window at the way these kind of operations work. In January of 1979, the U.S. Ambassador Adolf Dubs went to his own CIA station chief in Kabul at the embassy, and he said, "Is Hafizullah Amin a CIA agent? Is he working for you?" That's how confused the situation was. There were two things happening at the same time. You had the traditional State Department policy of working these governments on a diplomatic basis, and then, of course, in the summer of 1978, Zbigniew Brzezinski had taken over the action arm of the CIA, the Directorate of Operations, And obviously, there were all kinds of things percolating in the background. We know now, of course, that there was a Chinese, Iranian, Pakistani, Saudi Arabian access that was preparing to destabilize Afghanistan. And, of course, in the summer of 1979, as admitted by Zbigniew Brzezinski, he prepared a document for President Carter to sign, which he admitted would probably lure the Soviets into Afghanistan because it was so destabilizing what the United States was doing by providing propaganda means and training for these mujahideen that would probably lure the Soviets in there. And that was something that even Robert Gates is very frank about this. Our current Secretary of State was at the CIA in the late 1970s. In his book, From the Shadows, he talks specifically, the subheading in one of his chapters, if anything was well known, it was that the Soviets were going to be intervening in Afghanistan at the beginning of 1979, because they were building provocations in order to make that happen. It was fulfilled with the Soviet invasion in the December of 1979. Those self-fulfilling prophecies were fulfilled.
You write on page 308 about the radicalization of the Northwest Frontier Province tribes, the recruitment of Arab al-Qaeda fighters by the CIA and Pakistan's ISI. That's the Inter-Services Intelligence Agency there. This supposedly to help Pakistan's General Zia to conquer South Central Asia. That would then be ostensibly shared with the West.
General Zia actually had extensive conversations with Selig Harrison about that very issue. In fact, this is a quote from Selig. General Zia spoke to me about expanding Pakistan's sphere of influence to control Afghanistan, then Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and then Iran and Turkey. And that design continues through General Mohammad Aziz, who was involved in that plan with Zia, has now been elevated to a key position by Chief Executive General Pershav Musharraf. So you can see that the continuation of this process is continuing to this day. You would say, well, how does that serve American interests? Well, first of all, you really have to not see American interests as monolithic. There are definitely different kinds of American interests that are represented by the complete destabilization of Afghanistan and really maintaining Pakistan as a military enclave. And especially when you consider the fact that the function of the Shah really was replaced effectively by this continuing military position of Pakistan.
What's so surprising is that it would appear that so many mistakes have been made. I mean, why did the United States decide it was in America's interest to get in league with Saudi Arabia and with Pakistan's Zia-ul-Haq in terms of radicalizing South Central Asia for the benefit of destabilizing the Soviet Union? They must have looked at the Soviet Union as being this impenetrable thing, that the only way that they could overcome them was by putting these people together in this kind of brew of extremism. But that was the first mistake. Okay, so the United States did that. And then when the Soviets finally threw in the towel and said, all right, we can't put up with this, we're just leaving, even if we don't get a good agreement with the United States, that was in 1989, the United States just simply turned its back on the situation and walked away. And then when the Afghan government fell, the PDPA government, the remnants of the Marxist government, fell in 1992, the United States once again didn't do anything. In fact, we now know that the United States more or less was complicit in helping the Pakistani ISI in the creation of the Taliban, which was a direct result in terms of the pacification of Afghanistan. And it's also well documented that the United States, Selig Harrison points this out in his book, Out of Afghanistan, that he had many discussions with the Americans in Pakistan who were running the operation in the 1980s, and the United States was not assisting the moderates, the King's people, the people who could have gone back, who were in a position to go back in 1989, 1992, and form a broad-based coalition government in Afghanistan, were not getting the support of the United States. In fact, the United States was specifically defaulting to Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate.
In fact, if you look at the history, it was really Zia ul Haq who actually began Islamizing the army. And this also is connected to when Representative Charlie Wilson decided to, you know, really funnel all the financing through Zia. Now, these were all the things going on, that part of the process that was actually activated was this radicalizing of what had been a much more secular military. It still was a military enclave, but it was much more secular. And then, of course, when you bring in the Saudis and the Wahhabism, and you merge that into the madrasas and the function of the madrasas, which really was part of the whole process of the extremism really being promoted. But once again, you know, in terms of what is Al-Qaeda, you know, the database, basically, of Islamists that were invited from all over the world to be, you know, emptying out the prisons from all over the world to basically fight the Soviets. That, in fact, Cheryl Bernard, who was a RAND specialist, has been quoted as saying that the United States intentionally chose the most criminal extremists, the most brutal kinds of Islamists they could possibly find, in the idea that they had to have them to beat the Soviet Union, that they needed them. And they didn't just kill the Soviets, they didn't just kill communists, they killed everybody.
Right. Following that defeat, the United States did nothing to change the situation. And then, when the situation got so out of control in the late 1990s, and of course resulting in the events of 9/11, the United States went in and chased out the Taliban and replaced them with nothing. They re-empowered the warlords who were so abusive and so bad that the people of Afghanistan were kind of acquiescing to the Taliban because the Taliban were less bad than the warlords. Well, the United States goes in 2001 and proceeds to impose these warlords back on the Afghan people. So needless to say, it's the United States sets itself up for a defeat. In the meantime, the Taliban aren't really defeated. They go over to the border into Pakistan. The United States, the Bush administration, gets an agreement from Pervez Musharraf's people that they will hunt out the terrorists and help break them down. They don't do that. The United States gives Pakistan $11 billion or something like that, $15 billion over 7 years in order to do this purpose. Pakistan claims they're doing it, and the United States claims they believe them. And of course, then suddenly we are confronted with, once again, the resurgence of the Taliban, the resurgence of Al-Qaeda. The news conferences come out of Washington with our military people standing in front of the microphone saying why they're in a more powerful position now than they were in 2001.
If you go back again to 19th century British Empire's goal was to colonize Afghanistan, I think what we're looking at today is the identical goal. The idea of subjugating Afghanistan is critical in the terms of these geostrategists like Zbigniew Brzezinski, who are carrying forward Mackinder's idea of controlling Eurasia is how you control the world. So when you then bring that up to, say, the Charlie Wilson's war phenomena, where the whole idea of the Mujahideen holy wars became they were the ones who were going to save Afghanistan, and when you actually end up realizing they were actually the ones who wanted to rob the Afghan women of the rights that had actually been very much a part, a natural part of the evolution of Afghan society going back to the early 20th century.
Explain the historical figures you call mystical imperialists and their impact on U.S. policy even today.
That ties into what Liz said about Halford Mackinder and the 19th century British geostrategist. We don't have any history aside from the covert history in Afghanistan. But the British have been there in that part of the world the British East India Company was chartered by Queen Elizabeth I in 1600. They moved into that part of the world. This was supposed to be a Christianizing enterprise. That was what these companies, someone we know around here referred to it as market Calvinism, was what this entire operation was about, to go in to bring Christianity at the point of a gun barrel and to convert these people in the British-controlled world into Christians. And that was the beginning, that was the bedrock of what this imperialist effort was all about coming out of Great Britain. That changed and morphed over the 400 years until the turn of the 21st century, but still, and from our own personal experiences, it took on a kind of mystical approach. If you look at the Kipling stuff, The Man Who Would Be King, there are countless articles today about Winston Churchill and how he wrote all these books about fighting the Waziris in Waziristan and that part of Afghanistan, and how this look at this country from a very almost medieval perspective, as opposed to looking at it from a 21st or 20th century modernist secular viewpoint, the people who are, and I believe Zbigniew Brzezinski could be probably counted into this group, these people are very motivated by a religious zeal that is underlying their faith in Western values, faith in Christian values, they're pushing into the Islamic world. We know that that was a very strong part of the Bush administration's efforts, the kind of born-again Southern Baptist approach to American foreign policy. The interesting thing about this is that the French and the Dutch and the British, when they went into these areas, developed a very sophisticated way of dealing with the world. At the end of the 19th century, prior to World War I, there was a great deal of dissatisfaction with the results of modernism. They were looking at the ancient cultures. They were driven to go into these areas in Afghanistan and Laos and Vietnam, and they referred to it as Indochina at the time, to try to seek the ancient wisdom. Okay, this was very much an aspect of this. Right up until the middle of the 20th century, there were people who were involved in this kind of mystical pursuit.
I want to read you a quote, though. I think Paul had mentioned East India Company political officer Alexander Burns and his recommendation to the British Empire that they really try to work with the Afghan people, because his experience was really summed up by a letter he sent to his mother in 1832. Quote, "The people of this country are kind-hearted and hospitable. They have no prejudice against a Christian and none against our nation." That's the end of the quote. So you see, this is really the quality that we're trying to help the Obama administration recognize today. This quality is still the exact same quality. And the recommendation that Burns made in the 1830s is the same recommendation we're making today. And we're saying, you work with these people, you will have a friend forever. You try to take away their own spirit, and you will never win.
Well, the U.S. military under General McChrystal has sounded as if it was working at cross purposes with the U.S.-supported Afghan leader, Hamid Karzai. He's been trying to do damage control, of course, about the civilian casualties from these U.S. operations.
Unfortunately, Hamid Karzai is a compromised character at this point. There have been a lot of allegations about that. Let's put it this way. He's in an impossible position, regardless of what Hamid Karzai does and has done on his own. He was put in an impossible position at the very beginning of the American involvement.
In fact, in 2002, Aloya Jirga, that represented the Afghan people, had requested that the king be returned back to Afghanistan. And the United States basically did not support that and actually pretty much forced the people to accept Karzai, their hand-picked person. So part of the problem that Karzai is suffering from today clearly harkens back to the fact that he really was never at some level truly legitimate. And then you look at the problems that have erupted, the warlords that really were forced on Karzai too, which once again, there's a lot of Afghans that said, why did he accept that? Well, this is part of the problem. One of the reasons that he was handpicked by the United States was obviously because he would in fact accept the guidance of the United States. And this is clearly a problem for the Afghan people. So how to view this election? Clearly, the lack of legitimacy goes back to 2001.
And as we said before, there are some core issues here that were never resolved. These tribal areas which reside within Pakistan really need to be resolved in terms of the populations of those places. And Pakistan has been playing a very duplicitous game in this from the very beginning. They've been telling the United States that some of these individuals who have been causing problems for Pakistan are terrorists and that the United States should assist them in executing those terrorists. And this is where it gets very murky, because you've got Baloch nationalist movements, you have Pashtun nationalist movements, you've got Sindhi nationalist movements, not to mention the fact that Afghanistan has also a strong nationalist movement. So the question is that all of those things play against Pakistan's military's interests. The Punjab is the majority population of Pakistan, and it's their military. So in getting attacks and sending Punjab military into Pashtun areas on behalf of a campaign to root out terrorism, you know, is just a recipe for failure. And it's right at the beginning. And this is what the Obama administration, we had hoped, would be attuned to going in there when they took over. But we're seeing a lot of muddle.
The truth is Pakistan has had and still has a very effective lobby. Pakistan interests dominate American foreign policy towards the region.
In fact, Holbrooke even complained about how effective the Indian and the Pakistani lobby were, and he's basically saying, there was an article in The Nation, I believe, a couple of months ago, in which he basically was quoted as saying, where's the Afghan lobbyist there?
So here's an impoverished country that has been atomized, its civil society is still not functioning, and they're supposed to spend money on a lobbyist. This is the kind of insanity that really is coming out of the Beltway, and this is part of what our book is trying to lay bare, is that the real crisis here is a crisis in leadership coming from the United States.
Now, have the goals, finally, of the man you call a modern neocon Machiavelli, that Zbigniew Brzezinski, has his goal changed, do you think? Or is he still trying to lead Obama policy toward the same direction he tried to lead Carter policy?
He is still trying to forge a relationship with China against the interests of Russia. This is what he did. He's played the so-called China card in the late 1970s, and there's some very good documentation on the way in which he did this, and we cite this in the book. The Carter administration didn't necessarily want to go against the Soviet Union. They wanted to open up trade relations, a better relationship on a much more equilateral basis with both China and the United States. Zbigniew Brzezinski made sure, by doing some very undiplomatic things, that Russia would fear the United States opening up a military relationship with China. He went out of his way to make sure that the Russians knew that the United States was interested in almost a unilateral relationship with China against the interests of the Soviet Union. So that all played into the thinking that was going into the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in 1979. And of course now, he still has that goal. He's been cited as wanting to establish a kind of special relationship with China against the interests of Russia, and promoting oil pipelines and gas pipelines is an example, routing around Russia's interests.
And he would definitely be in the category of supporting a very subdued Afghanistan, and that Pakistan should remain basically the military enclave to be the sort of the hegemon of the region.
So the bottom line of this whole thing is that even from the early 19th century, astute British observers like Alexander Burns were saying a strong central Afghanistan is a much better post for the region. At the time, it was a good post for the British Empire. Today, it would be a good post for everyone involved in South Central Asia, all the nationalities, the Pakistani people, the Afghan people, the Iranian people.
And we also, of course, have to deal with India and Pakistan,
right,
and resolve that. That's critical.
So a strong central Afghanistan, this was argued against over and over again in the British Parliament, and the Liberals always lost to the Conservatives, the so-called forward policy people. And once again, we're embarked on another kind of forward policy, which is a direct takeover from the 19th century British ambitions, and of course we know where that went.
The War Resisters League says the budget for Afghanistan is expected to reach about $200 billion this year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we spent a lot of money in the 80s, wound up paying Pakistani leaders like Zia, warlords like Gulbuddin Hekmatyar. Can this all bankrupt America?
One of the things that was observed in 2001 was that fixing Afghanistan would have been relatively inexpensive if it had been done correctly, if it had been smart, and if the United States had not diverted its resources away from its ideological purpose of conquering Iraq, as an example.
The other side of it, too, is the fact that the billions of dollars that's already been spent really never hit the ground. So we really have a problem in the way in which we do business that is playing into the ongoing crisis. In 2001, when the United States bombed the Taliban across the border into Pakistan, we had an opportunity that the Afghan people were absolutely ready to embrace, ready to forgive the bombing of Afghanistan and the thousands of Afghans that died in the bombing, because they really were being subjugated by the Taliban. Now we come up to 2009, and the fundamentals still haven't been done. But there are a lot of wealthy organizations out there that have a lot of individuals that have made a lot of money off of the construction money and off of the redevelopment money that really never hit the ground. So we have been working with the wrong people, and we seem to continue to do that. So we state a goal. We want to bring stability. But when you really look at the people that have been empowered to actually handle the process, you see that it's repeating the same mistakes of the past.
Washington is a very powerful place, and it has the ability to project its idea of the world that it is operating in very effectively, and it can live in that world for a suspended period of time. We were in Vietnam for probably 20 years, okay, before it finally dawned on those in Washington that it was a non-sustainable engagement. Now, the United States, we hear all kinds of debates going on about whether the United States should even be in Afghanistan or not. The fact is that everybody else is going to be in Afghanistan. This is just simply a reality. How is the United States going to be there? The fact is that the American involvement in Afghanistan to date has been mainly military, and it has been mainly ineffective. I believe that what the Obama administration is trying to do is to establish some kind of credibility with the Afghan people by putting more troops in there, perhaps securing some kind of calm in terms of taking out some of these major Taliban leaders or Al-Qaeda leaders, and providing some kind of security so that they can get something done, some roads built in Helmand province, and get some waterworks going, and get some industry and some kind of agriculture aside from poppy growing going. I think that that's probably what it is, but the truth of the matter is that 17,000 troops or even 50,000 troops, which some people have suggested, is not going to make a difference. That country requires, according to the latest estimates that were just released, somewhere in the vicinity of 818,000 troops in order to pacify the country.
We need a whole new transformation.
That's not going to happen. Those troops are not going to materialize. The clouds aren't going to open. Those troops are not going to come down from the heavens.
We can, though, focus a lot more attention on demilitarizing Pakistan. We demilitarize Pakistan, and we will resolve a lot of the problem that is overwhelming Afghanistan that would require 800,000 troops.
This is not Vietnam. Afghanistan is a very, very critical part of the world. There's a lot of people and a lot of different countries that are involved there. They all have their own special interests. And the fact is, the Soviet Union had its special interests, too, in the late 1970s, when it was trying to secure its southern border and got involved with trying to maintain a progressive modern society in Afghanistan, and it failed to do that. The United States is not clear. The United States is in a much more disadvantaged position today than the Soviet Union, ironically, was in 1978, 1979. The United States, I think, is probably a lot weaker right now in terms of its own economy, in terms of its own prestige around the world. And so as a result, this really is a very critical issue that's going on. It is bankrupting the society. But it isn't Afghanistan that's bankrupting the society. Afghanistan is the last chapter in a whole mentality that began at Pearl Harbor in 1941 and continued with the creation of the Cold War, in which Washington seems to think that the only way we can identify ourselves in the world is against somebody we're in opposition to, whether it's the Germans and the Japanese in World War II or the Russians during the Cold War. Or this is kind of the debate that's going on in Washington right now. Who is our enemy? What we're saying is that the system's broken. It doesn't work. And unfortunately, there are some people in this country, a political movement in this country, which seems to just want to tear everything apart and not replace it with anything. We'd like to see some kind of sensible dialogue here. But in order to get that sensible dialogue, we're going to have to go back and reassess. We have to have our own reconciliation council in the United States. We have to sit down and actually start debating what's really important here. What is important to us? The healthcare issue is probably the biggest single factor here in this country, that every other industrialized nation in the world has a healthcare system. We can't get this across to anybody here in this country.
Elizabeth Gould, some people are advocating a U.S. military withdrawal, getting America out of Afghanistan now.
At this point, the Afghan people actually probably would like to see NATO and the United States completely withdraw. But that does not mean that they don't need help. They need serious help. So if the United States wants to play a positive role, then we really have to completely change the way we're doing our business with the Afghan people. We know that there are a lot of Americans who have stated the fact that they would just like to see the Americans withdraw. And our greatest concern right now is the fact that in the 1990s, when the United States basically looked the other way and the Civil War took place, the Taliban emerged and basically overwhelmed the Afghan people. This is clearly a concern today. But at this point, belief in the American to actually really help the people is really at a crisis level. And this is where we really have to, I think, as Americans, we really have to reflect back on what really has happened. And I think that's the biggest problem for a lot of Americans when they say things like, let's just get out. They literally mean we owe them nothing. Well, that's really not the case at all. And that's what we really need to address. And that's where we really need to be able to reflect back on really what happened, the U.S. role, how intimately the United States has been involved in that region, and how American policies have, in fact, caused the crisis, and how that means we have to change American policy to correct it.
Journalists Elizabeth Gould and Paul Fitzgerald have been critical of the false history portrayed in films like Charlie Wilson's War and in the corporate press. You can find their historical book about Afghanistan and their articles online at invisiblehistory.com. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network, talknationradio.org.